From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Soul Music Week continues with the great singer, the Reverend Al Green. We'll hear about his life and music before and after he was born again. Also, the Philly sound. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Philadelphia International Records, and we hear from one of the label's most popular singers of the 70s, Teddy Pendergrass. Soul Week continues coming up on Fresh Air.
You see, I can make a ship sail on dry land, chillin', yeah. On a happy mind with all the power that I possess, yeah.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. We're hearing from soul singers, songwriters, producers, and session musicians. Teddy Pendergrass is one of the singers most identified with the Philly sound of the 70s. He was the lead singer for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, which had such hits as If You Don't Know Me By Now and The Love I Lost. When he went solo, he became the first black male singer to record 5 consecutive multi-platinum albums. In 1982, he was in a car crash that left him a quadriplegic. He slowly returned to singing and performing. I spoke with him in 1998, after the publication of his autobiography, Truly Blessed. Before we hear the interview, to set the scene, our rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the early history of Philadelphia International Records, the label that Pendergrass recorded for in the 70s and early 80s. Ed says that by 1970, the black music scene in America was ripe for something new. The answer came from producers Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff in Philadelphia.
When Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff signed the deal establishing their Philadelphia International label as a division of CBS in 1970, they had the major pieces of what was to become an empire in place. Their old group, the Romeos, formed the basis for the Philadelphia International house band, MFSB, and they already had a working relationship with a studio, Sigma Sound, and its brilliant engineer, Joe Tarsia. They had startup money from CBS, and now all they needed was some hits. It took them a while, but in the summer of 1972, things went wild.
What they do? They smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers.
Backstabbers. They smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers.
Backstabbers.
All you fellas who have some woman and you really care. Yeah.
The OJ's Backstabbers was the decisive moment, a pop and soul hit that established the veteran group and Philadelphia International at the same time and gave a hint as to what Gamble and Huff were up to. Within weeks, another group that had been hanging around without much success also had the Philly magic applied to them and started their own string of hits.
Should understand me like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home.
Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes had had one weakness, namely Harold Melvin. Gamble and Huff pulled Melvin's drummer, Teddy Pendergrass, out from behind his kit, and with him as the lead vocalist, the group never looked back. Next up for the treatment was a former Supper Club vocalist.
Going on. it's strong, but it's much too strong to let it go now.
Billy Paul's Me and Mrs. Jones showed that sexual morality had changed. Never before had there been a pop hit about adultery. By the time this run of smashes had run its course, Philadelphia International had sold 10 million singles. The OJ's Backstabbers album alone had sold 700,000 copies. What was the formula? It was complex. First, there were the big arrangements, often by Bobby Martin or Tom Bell, which really found their groove at album length. Second, of course, was the talent, all veterans of the road and able to go out and perform the hits live, or on Soul Train, for which MFSB provided the theme music. Third, as a black-owned company in a time of increasing militancy in the black radio business, Philadelphia International's promotion men had easy entree to black tastemakers and had CBS's resources behind them. And fourth, well, there was that beat.
Well, downhearted. You might try to do. Bad luck fella's got a hold on you. Don't spend your money, about to lose your home. Done lost your woman and everything you own. All that is plain mistakes that chances go around. And if you want to know the truth about it, I'll tell you what's pulling you down, yeah.
Although the swishing cymbal sound wasn't the only rhythmic trick the label's arrangers had up their sleeves, it was invented and perfected by MFSB's drummer, Earl Young, and formed the basis of most early disco music. In fact, Motown only cracked the disco market in 1976 with Thelma Houston's nearly note-perfect copy of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes' Don't Leave Me This Way, which, in the embarrassment of riches, had been a mere album track for them. Ironically, part of what did Gamble and Huff in was disco. Cheaper to produce because it didn't require stars or big arrangements, it began to flood the market. Another problem was payola. Kenny Gamble was indicted for making payoffs, and CBS began to back off. But by the time Philadelphia International began to fade away in 1975, it had released dozens of classic songs, sold millions of records, and had not only started disco, but provided the template for many of today's Loverboy singers. It's something to be proud of.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock historian. He lives in Berlin. Before we meet singer Teddy Pendergrass, let's hear one of the solo recordings he made for Philadelphia International Records after he left Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. This is Love TKO, recorded in 1980.
Looking back over my years, I guess I shed some tears. I told myself time and time again, this time I'm gonna win. But another fight, things ain't right, I'm losing again. Takes a fool to lose twice, start all over again. Think I better let it go. Looks like another love TKO. Oh, think I better. What you think about it, girl?
Ever since the 1982 car crash that left Teddy Pendergrass paralyzed from the chest down, it's been difficult for him to perform. In May, he gave his first full concert since the crash. He has several more concert dates coming up. In 1998, he told me that he sang in church as a child. At the age of 10, he thought he was called to preach, and he started giving little sermons. I asked Teddy Pendergrass if he thought he'd grow up to be a preacher.
That is what I'm sure my mother thought I would do. And at the time, until I learned different, until I grew up, that's probably what I thought I would do as well. It's just that when you reach that ripe old age of 13, young kids, you know, they start to grow up and grow out, and they get, you know, get into their own thing and start doing their own thing. And I started getting involved in music and becoming interested in what we call secular music. And I saw a chance to see Jackie Wilson.
You said that experience really changed you.
It changed my life around. So it was.
What was it about the Jackie Wilson performance?
Just a consummate performer to me. Just my image of him was just so huge, and he was just such a master, a taskmaster. He controlled the stage. I'd never seen anybody do it before like him. And he just controlled that stage. His audience was in the palm of his hands. And as I say in the book, you know, the ladies ran down to the front of the stage when they thought he had fell off to hurt himself. He had just rolled off intentionally and rolled off onto the floor. And to see the ladies run through the guardrails and just lay on top of him and appear to make mad, passionate love to him in the middle of the floor at whatever time it was that morning, to me it was just, my jaws dropped. I was like, my God.
How can I do that?
Right. Yeah. That's what I wanted to.
You first performed professionally with a small group that you met in Atlantic City. And then you moved on from that group to perform with the Cadillacs. And the Cadillacs' big hit had been Speedo, but I think this was a period when the Cadillacs had kind of franchised, so there were several there were several groups singing under the name the Cadillacs.
Right,
happening more and more with oldies acts now. I'm wondering if anybody ever got really angry with you when they realized that this wasn't necessarily the original
Cadillacs. They didn't get mad at me because I was a drummer. I was just a guy in the band.
All right.
I could care less.
Did they get angry, though, at the singers?
I don't know. I could care less.
Really?
It was a job. It was an opportunity to, like, begin to do what it is I wanted to do. Thank goodness I had ability to play as well as sing. So, therefore, I could get a job playing until I could find a job singing.
So drums was secondary to you. What you really wanted to do is sing.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Melvin needed more backup singers, so he hired the group you were with, the Cadillacs, to be his new Blue Notes.
Mm-hmm.
So there you were, part of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. As the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
How did you start singing, even though you were hired as the drummer? Because you became the lead singer.
Yeah, that was an interesting transition. How do I explain? As the drummer, I was the only musician that Harold hired from the band, which was the band for the Cadillacs. So he took the singers, and he liked the way I played so much, he offered me a job. At the time, I said, oh, okay, more money, just another job. You know, he didn't fire me. Great, fine. We began to realize or recognize that sometimes the group would be late. If they were late, and came late, the club owners would dock them. We would all make less money. So the band began to sing the songs that the group would sing if they were late in order to make sure and ensure that we got paid. So sometimes the Blue Notes would come in and hear us singing, and I'd be sitting on the drums playing and singing. So then they realized, oh, this guy can sing. And from there, just evolved and evolved, evolved and evolved.
My guest is singer Teddy Pendergrass. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with singer Teddy Pendergrass. Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes was signed by Gamble and Huff, mm-hmm. Philadelphia International Records. What do you think was unique about their approach to production? And maybe another way I should put it first is, what changed about the sound of the group once you were part of Philadelphia International?
Well, I think what Kenny and Leon saw was when they came to see us at the Apollo Club in Camden, New Jersey in 1970, what they heard was a group with a lot of dimension. They saw a group with a lot of class, a lot of savvy, a lot of experience. If nothing else, Harold was a taskmaster, and he was extremely, extremely knowledgeable about show business and how we should perform, what we should look like, how you should, as a unit, how you should do things together. The choreography was like one person was dancing. I mean, we truly could work the gamut because we had to. We had to work in front of little white ladies with blue hair in Miami Beach, and we had to work in front of pimps and hustlers and prostitutes in New York or Buffalo or wherever we were. So we had to really know what we were doing in order to continue to work, because we were working because of our reputation. We had no records.
I want to play one of your really big hits during the Philadelphia International era with Harold Melvin and
Please
the Blue
do.
Notes. This is The Love I Lost. You say in your memoir that originally this was supposed to be a ballad, but then the tempo got picked up. What were the changes that this song went through during the production, and why did it go through them?
It's just once you're in the studio, magic happens, because you're in there with live musicians, and as you try different feels, as you try things, and that's the ability that you have with live musicians that you don't have with computers.
This is The Love I Lost, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing you.
The love I lost was a sweet love. Hoping that you and I could make it all through, but something went wrong. We loved each other, we just couldn't get along. Take a good look at me, I'm in misery. Can't you see? But love was a sweet love.
I Lost, one of the big hits of the 70s, with my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing lead.
Oh, that was good. I haven't heard that song in a long time.
Did your fans realize that the lead voice they were hearing was the voice of Teddy Pendergrass and not Harold Melvin? Because the group is called Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and you would assume that he was the lead singer.
Right. Well, my friends knew, but nobody else knew. And that was what really got me after a while. So, a lot of times...
Do people not believe you sometimes? You say, but that's me singing lead, did they say?
Not sure. My I didn't really tell anybody. Oh. I'm not one like that. But however, in clubs and places we would work, and they would come to me and go, oh, that was a great show, Harold. And I'd say, I'm not Harold, that's Harold. And people would just kind of look like, huh? You know, I guess they thought I was on dope or dog food or something, because I wasn't acknowledging that I was who they just knew I was. And that was quite different. And it got to a point on our third album that I demanded that my name be put on the record. I was tired of being called Harold, and I wanted my just dues.
And then eventually
I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to be recognized.
After you went on your own, you eventually started doing, in addition to your regular concerts, you started doing for women only shows. What was the difference between what you did on stage or what you sang in the for women only shows than the rest of your concerts?
The difference was they were probably a little more provocative. I probably played to the audience a lot more because they were all female, and subtle differences like that.
So what would you do that was different?
Played to the audience a little differently. Nothing obscene. You just give of yourself more to your audience rather than to just play with the band or just kind of get through a show, because if you're going to do it for a women-only show, you have to kind of appease the women in the audience. So don't look for things that I would do, like pull my pants down or nothing like that. No, nothing like that.
What impact did it have on your ego and your personal life to be a romantic icon?
Did it have, and does it have, or did it, because it's not over?
So my impression, though, is that your ego is in a different place now than it was before. My impression, just from things that you've said, is that you felt that your ego at times was a little out of control earlier, and that's no longer the case.
It was all new. All new. And when you get that kind of adulation and people are just at your beck and call and at your feet, giving you what you want. I was a young kid, 26 years old, 27 years old, 20, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can alter your thinking from it. Sometimes your head is too big to get through a door. And mine got there. I was able to, bring things back into perspective, but yeah, it can alter your ego and give you a nice big one. I mean, at 28 years old, I was buying a 34-room mansion in Gladwin. It's kind of, coming from a row house in North Philadelphia and buying my mother a home a mile and a half away and filling up a garage with Rolls Royces and Ferraris. I don't know a whole lot of people that do that.
Teddy Pendergrass, recorded in 1998. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I know Jesus, he will fix it.
Coming up, Soul Music Week continues with the Reverend Al Green. We hear excerpts of his two Fresh Air interviews. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. We're featuring interviews with soul singers, songwriters, session musicians, and producers. Al Green had a string of hits in the 70s, including Take Me to the River, Tired of Being Alone, Let's Stay Together, Call Me, and Love and Happiness. His ballads were about as great as soul singing gets.
Love and happiness. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love. Love.
love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, talking about how she can make it right. Yeah, happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone. Yeah.
Like many of the performers we're hearing from this week, Al Green sang gospel before crossing over to soul music. But in the 70s, after having fallen prey to many of the temptations and problems that fame often brings, he was born again and returned to gospel. In 1976, after being ordained as a minister, Al Green bought a church in Memphis, the Full Gospel Tabernacle, where he continues to preach. Al Green has joined us twice on Fresh Air. We're going to hear excerpts of both interviews. He started performing at the age of 9 with his family's gospel group in rural Arkansas, where his father was a sharecropper. Last year, after the publication of Al Green's autobiography, we talked about his early years. Your father sang gospel music and traveled around. You had a brother group.
Right.
You and your brothers sang,
did
the whole gospel circuit.
Right.
When did you start getting serious about singing?
When I got put out of the house.
And why did you get put out of the house?
For listening to Jackie Wilson and Otis Redding and people like that. And Daddy wanted to keep the group a gospel group. I mean, we need to sing gospel. You need to turn that off. And I'm going like, well, but I want to hear it. And I had a Elvis Presley album, and I had never been to Memphis. I'm 14 years old, and I have all these Love Me Tender and Teddy Bear and Jailhouse Rock and all this stuff. And I'm not saying because I'm from Memphis. I had never been to Memphis. I was in Michigan. And Dad says, that's a bunch of junk, man. You need to consider what you're doing. You're singing gospel music, and you need to consider singing gospel music. So I got this brand new album called Baby Workout by Jackie Wilson. And, oh, I just looked at the cover, and this guy had all these fine pictures on it, and I says, oh, I got to play it. So I went and I opened it up, and I put it on, and by the time Jackie Wilson said, oh, baby, move up, first step, Daddy come in the door and caught me. I said, oh, Lord. I got, so he went through third degree with me, and I was out of there. But I had a friend, luckily enough, lived right in back of us, named Lee Verges. And his father and his mom, his wife and himself took me in. I had nowhere to go, really. And they took me in. But now this Lee Verges was a tenor singer in a group that Palmer James and Curtis Rogers had started, and they called themselves the Creations. And so we used to rehearse in the house every day, because we had nothing to do anyway. Every day we had rehearsal at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we would just get up, stand in a line and form and try to come up with little dances like we'd see the Temptations do on the TV. And that's right.
So what kind of material did you sing with the Creations?
God, we sung everything that was on the radio.
Covers.
I mean, that's right. Dr. Bay, Wilson Pickett, James. I mean, we just sung a little group. We just sung anything.
The Reverend Al Green recorded last year talking about first hearing and singing rhythm and blues. We'll return to that interview a little later. In 1991, I spoke to Al Green before a concert in Philadelphia. I wanted to know if he was still singing soul songs or just performing gospel music. Are there songs of yours that you won't sing now?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Well, I can't sing some songs because I wrote them because of I Love You, Baby, Darling, I Care for You. You know, I wrote them because of sensual love. I want to take you in my arms and sweep you off my feet, put you on a plane, go to a nice resort area with a cold bottle of champagne and kiss you. Mwah, 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 mwah. I wrote them because of that. And then, but now like Let's Stay Together, I wrote for couples because whether times are good or bad, happy or sad, whether we're right or wrong, forgiveness is in there. And we can always make up. That's always a lot of fun. And we can go on with our lives being what we're supposed to be.
Now, how do you feel when you hear your sensual secular songs on the radio?
I feel kind of funny, and then I kind of blush, you know, because I've spent so much time under the book now. And so when I hear some of those songs, I kind of blush, you know, and I go, did I actually say that? You know, here I am, come and take me. Well, I did it because of I was so flamboyant, and I was so, kind of had an air of arrogance, you know. And I sung it because here I am, come and take me. You understand? And you know how that is. And so I learned to be more humble, more giving, more loving, and more understanding, you know, in that, yeah. So it's a little different, but still strong.
Well, Al Green, I'm going to play Let's Stay Together.
Let's play that.
That's something you still sing, right?
I still sing. I'm singing that tomorrow night.
Okay, here we go. My guest Al Green and his hit recording of Let's Stay Together. Do you remember how you met Willie Mitchell, who was the person who signed you to High Records and produced all the hits that you had with High?
Yeah, I remember how I met him.
How'd you meet him?
I met him in the country out in Midland, Texas, in Odessa, Texas, out there. I met him out there, and he asked me about going to Memphis to sing on a recording because he worked at a studio. And we were riding in the car that day, and I said, how long do you think it'll take me? I was so flamboyant. I don't understand how I did it. I was riding with this guy, and I says, how long will it take me to become a star? He says, and he swallowed and like choked, right? He says, a star? Well, about 2 years probably if you really work at it. I said, excuse me, let me out. I don't have any kind of time. He says, you're not serious. I said, I'm serious. I don't have 2 years to waste on practicing to become a star. I need some money now. And really, so he took me down to High. He says, this kid's going to be phenomenal. They says, how do you know that? He says, because he's got it in him. And so he borrowed $1,500 for me from the president of the company to get me a place to stay and all that, and says, I want to work with him because he's going to be phenomenal. Just watch.
Gee, it really pays to have chutzpah, huh?
I guess I just told him I wanted to be what I wanted to be.
The Reverend Al Green is my guest. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1991 interview with Al Green. When we left off, he was talking about meeting Willie Mitchell, who produced many Al Green hits. Now the first song that he asked you to record was a cover of the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand, right?
Would you believe that?
It really is hard to believe. Why did he choose that?
I have no idea.
What was your reaction to it?
My reaction was good. I thought it was a great song. It was a wonderful song, but it was for the Beatles. I sung I Want to Hold Your Hand. I sung Driving Wheel. We was trying to find Al Green. That's what we was trying to find. Who is this guy? Who is this guy with the high falsetto and the rough voice And Willie says, I tell you what, don't sing with a rough voice. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He's cutting all these different songs about different people, just a lot of songs. He says, sing mellow. Don't sing hard, sing mellow. And I just went out there and started singing, I'm so tired of being alone. And I'm so tired of on my own. Help me, girl, as soon as you can. And I looked in the studio mirror. They have this glass, right? And you're looking at the engineers. Yeah. And everybody was jumping up and jumping up and jumping up. And I says, well, I must be doing something right. So I just keep on saying, people say. And that's, I don't know how that started. That's the way it started.
Well, that was your song. It was a song you wrote. So
yeah.
You already had it written.
Yeah, I said, well, after we got done cutting all these other people's songs, the Beatles and, and all these blues songs and the Temptations, I Can't Get Next to You and all these songs, I says, I got a song too. So Willie says, oh, please. Because he'd been cutting all day. We'd been cutting all day. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I says, I got me a song and I wrote it on my own. So Willie told one of the guys, go out there and see what he got, would you please? I got to have a drink. Willie had a little shot of vodka or something. And after he went to feeling better, he says, all right, what we got out here? And it was this song, Tired of Being Alone. And I worked it up with the band. And I sung it and it became our first million seller.
Well, I'm going to play it.
Let's play it. Come on. Let's play it.
This is Al Green's first big hit, a song he wrote, Tired of Being Alone. Al Green, my guest today, singing Tired of Being Alone. I want to get back to a story you were telling before we heard that about, you know, how you had to sing the I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah.
It's your first song. How did you sing that? I mean, what voice did you use?
I don't know. I just kind of sang, hey, you got that something that I think I understand. When I feel that something that I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Like that.
That sounds great.
I sung it in 71. That was 19 years
ago. Right. Right. So when you wrote Tired of Being Alone, were you alone? Were you tired of being alone?
Yeah, well, my girlfriend kept leaving me the key and leaving the apartment. And she would leave me a lot, and I was, and I says, well, how, it was snowing one night, and I had all the windows open because I was there by myself for hours on end. And I says, well, how can I do something with this? How can I make something out of this? And so I took a pencil and started writing it down. Because I was angry, and I was writing, I'm tired of being alone, I'm tired of on my own. Then I wrote several other things. I scratched those out, and I said, help me as soon as you can. And then I went to getting serious about it. People say that I found a way to make you say that you love me, which is I don't have to make you. If you really love me, you'd be here with me. And I was writing on that connotation. You didn't go for that. It's a natural fact. That, yeah, like that.
Had you written songs before?
Maybe one song before, that's all.
Oh, so this was something like newly discovered when you were recording this?
Yeah, everything was discovered at that time because we didn't have anything to, to no resources to kind of go back and say, I can do this or that.
One of the records that you made that was a cover of another recording was To Sir With Love.
Yeah.
And this had to be, like, when you saw the movie, you had to think of this as, like, a real corny song, right?
Yeah.
You had such a great version of it. Was it your idea to record the song?
I always wanted to record the song for years.
Why?
I don't know. I heard this lady sing this song on a movie of something, some lady from England, and I heard this song. And I wanted to sing that song. And nobody was interested in letting me sing it. My producer says, come on, you don't want to sing it, sir, with love. They would always figure out a way how to cut me off, you know. Well, let's everybody break, you know what I mean? So we never cut to Sir With Love. So I says, when I got my own studio, you know, after I came to the point where I wanted to sing gospel, everybody in Los Angeles and in L.A. says that's a bad idea. Everybody in Memphis said, oh, God, he's not going to try something else. I said, but I've got to sing gospel. I'm born again, and there's a lot of good that can be done from singing gospel as well. I went to my studio in Memphis, set up a studio, had Bill Cantrell to put it together, and recorded The Lord Will Make a Way, and all those Highway to Heaven and all those songs on that same album in a makeshift studio. And that was the pivotal point in the Al Green career of things. But since then, I've come to know Al Green. I've come to know myself better. I've come to know.
So you recorded To Sir With Love during that session?
Mm-hmm. During that time period, during the next two albums there, yeah. I cut it because I want to cut it so bad.
I'm going to play it.
Let's play it.
This is To Sir With Love, sung by my guest, Al Green. The Reverend Al Green is my guest. There's a story about you that's kind of legendary in music lore. And I'm thinking of the story of the time a woman you were with poured hot grits or hot oatmeal or something
cream of wheat
on you while you were in the bath and yeah. Scalded you and then took her life.
Yeah.
She killed herself afterwards. Is there a connection between that story and your being born again?
Nah, not whatsoever. People in journalism like to say that was the reason, but I was born again in 73. This incident happened in 1974, so it really don't correlate, and they like to have it to be so that it correlates, but it doesn't. I was born again because they saw what I could be, not what I was. They knew what I was. I was a no good, woman hunting, champagne drinking, good time having, Saturday night, blues singing man.
Singer Al Green, recorded in 1991. Coming up, we'll hear how he was born again. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're listening back to a pair of interviews with soul singer Al Green. He was ordained as a minister in 1976. During our conversation last year, he told me about the night he was born again in a California hotel room, during a time when his mind was on being a soul music star and all the perks that came with it. Were you surprised when you had your born-again experience?
Oh, my God, yes. I was at a party. I was in San Francisco. I mean, I played the Cow Palace. I had my little diamond on, you know, and I called and had my girlfriend to fly out from Detroit. I'll take care of the ticket, you know. Oh, I was tippy-tippy-tippy-tippy-tippy-toe. Oh, I was in, oh, honey, I was gone, you know. So Disney sent their plane up and picked us up in San Francisco, flew us down to Anaheim to do the 12 o'clock show that night, right? And we did the show, me and the band on, having a little champagne and, you know, the girls all on the plane and, you know, we just having fun and talking and chilling, you know? So my girlfriend came, and so after the show, the second show that night, I was kind of tired. I said, babe, I said, I am zonked. I says, I'll just see you in the morning. She said, well, after that flight, oh, man, it's about 3 or 4 hours, 5 hours or whatever it was. She said, I'm tired, too. I'll see you in the morning. I said, okay, great. Well, I'll see you in the morning. Mwah, bye-bye. And, you know, she went that way inside the suite and closed the door, and I went that way inside the suite and closed the door. Now, between that time, which is about 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, to 4, 4.30 in the morning, this guy's born again here. And I've never been the same since that day, since that very day. I've never been the same. I've never been the same.
You have your own church now. You've had that church for how many
22
years?
22 years.
Do you often think, like, who would you have been, what would you have been doing if it wasn't for being born again and if it wasn't for your church? Like, what life would you be leading? Would you even be alive?
That's a good question right there. Man, that's a good question because there's so many of my friends that started when I started. Even in Philadelphia here and all around the country, Detroit and different other places. I don't know what I could have been, but I don't want to get caught up in all of that drug inducement, hallucination, Donnie Hathaway, so many of us that started at the same time. Oh, there's such a tragic aura around great success. Sam Cooke, all these people. There's such a, and I was afraid. Otis in the plane. I would be afraid to take a chance like that. I would rather hold on to the Lord and make Him. And let Him be the master of my life than me trying to do what we were doing coming from the Cow Palace down to Disney because, you know, I mean, my intentions was just to have a party. That's all I was thinking about. Now, this born again, waking up out of my sleep, you know, with the amen and the hallelujah and the thank you, Jesus, and the overflowing. And my dad came out, and he was across the hall, and he says, what's wrong with you, boy? And so he grabbed me by the shoulder, what's wrong with you? And I said, look at my hands. Look at my hands. And I'm crying. And he says, what's wrong with you? And I said, look at my hands. I mean, would you look at my hands? And he says, what's wrong with your hands? I said, look at my feet, look at my feet, look at my feet. And he says, so he turned right then and kind of like caught himself and turned. And he himself went to say, thank you, Lord. That boy has been saved. Thank you, Lord.
Al Green, I really wish we had more time, but we have to let you go. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
I'll go and sign books.
The Reverend Al Green recorded last year after the publication of his autobiography. He preaches at the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Memphis. Our soul music series continues tomorrow and concludes on Labor Day.
I don't know why I love you like I do. After all the changes that you put me through, used all my money in my cigarettes, and I haven't seen
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's edition of Soul Music Week was produced by Sue Spolin with Lauren Krenzel. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again, a novel by Elizabeth McCracken, the author of The Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sitting in the morning sun.
On the next Fresh Air, Soul Music Week continues with stories about the great soul recordings that came out of Stax Records and the Muscle Shoals Studio in Alabama. We'll hear from record producer Jerry Wexler, songwriter Dan Penn, guitarist Steve Cropper, and producer, songwriter, and singer Isaac Hayes. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Watching the tide roll.